Nice. Very, very excited to have you, the most holy Reverend Father Joseph Christina. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Joe, what's you're a pastor. What's your favorite thing about vicars?
Usually when they don't talk. So is the question what my favorite thing about vicars is or about vicaring?
That's actually good. What's your favorite thing about vicaring?
When I vicared, I was actually halfway through my year. The other pastor, I was at a pastor church in Appleton, Wisconsin, and one of them stormed out. He just left. He got done with it. So about halfway through my year, I ended up going basically from vicar to being an associate pastor there. And probably my favorite memory from that would have been my bishop, who would have been the pastor who was sort of in charge of me, sitting down with me in a meeting as we were nearing the end of winter and beginning of spring, the time for weddings. And mm-hmm. he asked me, as stuff's coming up here, he's like, do you want to do weddings or funerals? Because we were going to split all the, and I told him funerals. And to this day, if I ever talk to him, he never lets me live that down. He's always like, I should have never let that happen. Because funerals are nice because no one complains. And,
right.
And, at the weddings, it can be a completely different scenario. So.
People complain a lot with the weddings.
Well, yeah, but
they can.
I guess as you heard this morning, so do I. So, my favorite thing about vicars, I guess probably more than anything is it's just exciting to know that there are men out there who are passionate about ministry and are really and ready to take on that call because it can be interesting. To actually do that type of work and that vocation. So it's just encouraging for me to know that they're there.
Do you think it's possible to ever be like truly ready for ministry?
Personally speaking, no, absolutely not. I was out of ministry for a while, came back in when I joined the AALC, and I've experienced some very interesting things since I've been here, and I don't think anything can really prepare you for it. I sat in our narthex just down the hallway with a gentleman one time where, quite frankly, I didn't think I was going home. Yeah. It was a relatively terrifying event. And then another time I took one of our church neighbors to go get a hearing aid, and as we're passing a house in the neighborhood behind the church, he's like, oh, I shot the guy who lives there. And I'm like, oh, these things happen, I guess. But these are the kind of things that you just experience while. And so I don't, at the end, nothing can really totally prepare you for it. And I've always, my advice for vicars or for anyone entering the ministry has always been the day you feel like you belong there, quit. Because none of us really do. None of us really do. And I think since I've been in the AALC here at Christus Victor, the Lord has made it quite clear that this ain't me, that it's all him. He's the one who's really getting anything done here. So I'm grateful for that.
You, how long ago did you join the AALC?
Let's see. I've been here for 5 years. Or it will be 5 years in July, I believe. And prior to that, I think I had joined maybe a year or so prior to, and when I became one of their rostered clergy. They had asked me to consider a congregation in Iowa first. And but by the time I had been rostered and was one of their pastors now and eligible for a call, now it was kind of real for the nurse. So now, she kind of had to face, because we were living in Northern Illinois, where we're both from, where our families were at. And now I was asking her to, uproot and move. And so that was something that, it took a little bit of time before, she finally consented to that. And And by the time she did, that congregation in Iowa had already called. So Pastor Lyons called me and he's like, you know, I want you to consider these other congregations, one in South Dakota, one in Wyoming, one in, I can't remember where, and then Fayetteville. And I guess since we're not used to driving 45 minutes to get to a Walmart or having grizzly bears run through our backyard, the nurse was circled Fayetteville while I was still talking to him on the phone. And so anyways, here we are.
Here we are. Yeah. So you came to Christus Victor not too long before I did, I think, then.
No, it really wasn't. Yeah. Not all that long at all.
Yeah. Because, like, my first Sunday was the Sunday before Reformation Sunday in 2018. That was the first time I had ever stepped foot in a Lutheran church. And, I've been back just about every Sunday since, so that's good, I guess.
Yeah.
You grew up Wells and were ordained in the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. What are the big differences you've noticed going from Wells to Altar and Pulpit Fellowship with the LCMS, like AALC, you know?
There are things that, you know, for example, probably the biggest would be a prayer fellowship, you know, which is one of the things where the Wisconsin Synod would differ with LCMS, is that you can't really pray with someone unless they have the exact same confession as you do. But the thing is that in practice, most Wells families, you know, they have Thanksgiving, they have Christmas, they have, you know, dinners and things like that. And there's always some people in the family who go to an LCMS church or decided to go to a different evangelical church, you know, in town or whatever, because that happens. It happens sometimes regrettably, but it happens nonetheless. And they still pray. They don't ask them to walk away from the table or do anything like that. And I think just more, to be honest, since my only real exposure has not really been as much AALC as it has been Christus Victor. So that's some of the stuff that I'm learning, you know, just being with different people, people who have different mindsets, people who think differently, people who don't always think the same way politically and stuff. And so we've got everyone, you know, and all kinds of different opinions and things like that. And yet we still, by God's grace, manage to rally around the word and the confessions. And I think that's probably the, you know, that's probably the most refreshing thing about being here. So
I saw this ELCA pastor post a thing on Facebook, and it, you know, was so regrettably Elka all the way through about what church is. And it was, you know, this rhetorical flourish and fancy, you know, whatever, talking about what church is. And there was something in it, though, that I thought was really, really good. And it said, church is a place where you're forced into a family with people that you would otherwise have nothing to do with. And, like, you have to be their family. And not just like we hang out on Sundays for an hour, but, like, we're family. If you ever need anything, you call me. And it's someone that otherwise I would want nothing to do with, you know?
Yeah, it's definitely one of those things, like you said, you know, certain interests and things like that differ, you know, for everyone. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't necessarily all be, you know, hanging out at the same bar or restaurant time and all that. But with that said, I do view church and Christus Victor in particular, because it's, you know, my parish, as family. And we're very much like that. And it's, and I think
we are.
We've really developed that type of, I guess, cohesion or however you want to put it. One of the things I really marvel at are when we have potlucks or get, you know, gatherings like Easter breakfast, stuff like that. Our oldest members are usually mingling with our youngest lambs. You know, they're the ones, you know, and it's amazing to me to go to a shut-in, someone who's been, you know, close to one of the founding members of our church, And the thing they want to know is, how's Sunday school? How's right. how's things going there? You know, that's just so I bristle a little bit at compartmentalized ministry. You know, always the youth, you know, together, the elderly, you know, are you know, seniors together, or you know, and I know we do that. We have a women's ministry that gathers, and we have a men's Bible breakfast that gathers and stuff like that. But for the most part, you know, I really like the fact that we gather, and we gather as a family. And when I preach, I try to preach as if we're all sitting around a table, sitting around a huge kitchen table together. Because I know you've noticed, I will interact with people if they, you know, if I see them make a facial expression or whatever, you know, it might be. We won't do that to visitors, you know, but we don't just throw anyone, you know, on the spot like that. But
you know, if you notice that I'm reading my bulletin, you'll maybe call on me to answer some kind of question.
Yeah, well, you know, it's just Vickers, right? So you're just going to... So the I will do that often. Like we're I'll ask type of rhetorical kind of question, at least what I thought was when I wrote my manuscript, and then have one of the lambs in the congregation answer it
every time.
You know, and it's just like, well, you know, who is Jesus? Well, he's God. And then I would offer them my Bible and say, you want to finish this, kid? You can do this job, and stuff. So I do, like I said, we really. I don't know that it was intentional, but the family thing is definitely there. It's definitely there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It's. I was talking to someone else on this podcast about how it's been so neat to watch, like, Nancy sort of take my wife under her wing. And my wife, who is the most introverted person in the world and would never do anything that involved her being a public kind of person, up here doing cantor things and chanting and being in the choir and having solos in the choir and stuff like that. And it's been so great. And it's that kind of sisterly / motherly kind of affection and pushing from Nancy that's really helped my wife kind of blossom in this way.
And that's, and again, and she's just a gem for us, Nancy, as well as your wife, obviously. But the Nancy also has a little bit of, you know, her military background. She's very good at voluntelling people. And so, you know, where you make it seem like it's a request, but in reality, you're like, am I going to say no to this woman? I mean, she used to be an MP at one point in time. You don't mess with them.
So. Yeah. Be it far from me to say no.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. So what's one thing that you think you were pretty wells on that you've kind of softened? Or are there things that you weren't sure about wells-wise going to AALC that you think, the wells actually have that pretty spot on?
There's some of that. So I guess... you know, some of the things, some of our high church, higher church practices, things like that, that does not exist in the wells. Mm-hmm. So in the wells, I mean, most, and I shouldn't say it doesn't exist. It, there's some of it there, but most guys don't wear a collar.
Right.
They wear suit and tie. As a matter of fact, when I was getting ready to move here, my mom wanted to take me on like a shopping spree, you know, buy me a bunch of these new shirts and new ties and all. And I'm like, no, I'll just go to RJ Toomey. And get a couple shirts and as you well know, I don't even always wear the shirt and collar. You know, it's one of those things, you know, I'll you know, kind of wear whatever. I'm a very strong believer in setting the bar very low early, so that people aren't gonna, they're not going to expect you to, you know, constantly be dressed up, constantly, you know, that kind of stuff. And that's just not who I am. But I think, you know, as far as the wells goes, though, the training, my mom always says this, you know, don't ever be critical, if you will, of the training that I received. You know, I went to school for 9 years, 5 years of college, an undergrad, and then 4 at the seminary. The wells is very, very strong in languages. And when I say languages, I'm saying you have no choice. You have to learn these languages. And that's actually mostly what our undergrad program was. Now, I've been out of that loop for so long, I don't know if anything's changed, you know, if what things are like anymore in Mequon. But it's, I definitely don't take that for granted. The training was really good. Their doctrine is I mean, it's pretty sound. In fact, I think Dr. Jordan Cooper, mm-hmm. you may have heard of him. Yeah, I know he'll rely on a lot of their materials sometimes and their website for their essay file and things like that. So, I mean, it's not, you know, there's some good stuff there. I still get the Wisconsin Lutheran Quarterly, which is a quarter a year publication that has articles on it, exegesis type stuff and things like that. So I keep in that. But their practice, I think Pastor Jackson probably put it well one time when he tweeted a GIF, if you will, for every Lutheran church body. And the Wells one, I think, was Milhouse playing Frisbee with himself. Right. And I think that's the thing. So one of the things, because we're an association, we get an opportunity sometimes to do things that sometimes the Wells Church, you know, wouldn't have allowed or would have really, you know, been critical of. So, for example, we support the Agape Pregnancy Crisis Center here in town. Right. I get a newsletter from them. And when I say we support them, what happens is we collect items, you know, diapers, wipes, all that stuff. You know all this. But I suppose the people listening to probably don't know this. And we collect all these things. And then after a while, I bring them to this crisis center. And which, by the way, great story. The location of this pregnancy crisis center here in town is actually the former location of an abortion clinic. And this lady and her husband literally just bought them out. I mean, talk about building a cathedral over some temple ruins.
No joke.
And there's something, you know, I get the newsletter and all the Baptist churches in town support it, all these other churches, Methodist church. And then there's us, Christus Victor Lutheran Church, and there, you know, and so, and that's something that we have a little bit more autonomy in, being able to do that. And, you know, so, and there's just certain things we just can't do on our own. So we need to rely on organizations that do it much better than we do. So
it was, it's interesting because, so like the sainted Dr. R.C. Sproul, I listened to a talk from him on Christian fellowship, and he rightly said, you know, we can all celebrate anyone's baptism. That's wonderful. You've been baptized. That's great. We wouldn't celebrate communion with everybody unless we were in agreement on, you know, in some important matters of faith and doctrine. He said, but then there's this other category of things where I will stand arm in arm, he said, with anybody. He said, if we're marching to end abortion, I would stand arm in arm with a Muslim and an atheist. It's fine because, like, we're ending abortion. That's the thing we can, like, we can all agree that's evil, right? And so that's, and I don't know, is there are degrees, I think, like, of sort of cooperation and fellowship, you know, where we don't agree on much, but we can agree that this is bad or that this is good, you know.
Right. And that's really what makes, to be honest with you, that's what, to a very large degree, makes the history of this whole town. Yeah. We're made up of a bunch of different people, but boy, oh boy, when we figure out, you know, the Nazis or the commies or whatever, and we're like, they're bad, and we need to do something about it, that's, we're in lockstep then. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. 100%. It's wild to me. I had sat down with a Reformed guy for lunch. He invited me out to lunch like 2 years ago. And basically all he did was spend like 2 hours just like trying to make me Reformed, and grilling me on like Luther quotes. It was a weird thing, but we got to talking. The Wells pastor in town will go to his church because they were friends personally and would go to his church from time to time for, you know, a service here and there. And he mentioned how that guy, that was the first time I'd heard, they won't even pray with you. And he mentioned that, how that guy like wouldn't even, not just not take communion when they were having it, which I understand, he didn't understand, but I got that. I wouldn't have communion at a Reformed church, but they the guy wouldn't even pray with them when they were praying. Like, he would leave early or come late or whatever to skip the whole prayer bit. And I don't know. I thought that was a little kind of shocking, I guess. Like, what's the reasoning behind that?
Well, the reasoning behind that out of the Wisconsin Synod is because they look at prayer as an act of worship. And they're not completely wrong there.
Right.
But because it's an act of worship in their estimation, then it has to be practiced with someone who is in complete doctrinal unity with them. So that's why something like that will happen. But see, now the thing about that, though, is that Wells pastors could be leading their own Sunday worship service, and they will not ask visitors or others to come in who may come from different churches to not pray with them. They won't do that because they make a distinction then between, and this is something I've never really fully wrapped my head around, but they make a distinction between, you know, joining in prayer and being asked to lead the prayer. And for them, then that's how they sort of get around that whole thing. And so I'm not surprised. I met the guy. I actually met him shortly after I moved here. I went in, and he's someone who was actually a senior when I was a freshman in college. My schooling actually started at a place called Northwestern College, all guys. You can only imagine the amount of trouble we got into, because it's all guys just going to school to become pastors.
Right.
And some of the craziest times and parties of my life, it was just insane. And so he was like a senior, and he knew who I was, mainly because I don't have a very Wells name. Right. You need a good German name with like two N's at the end to be like a, you know, a full Wells pastor. And at least that's what it seemed like. And so here comes this kid, you know, this tan Italian kid, you know, who just never looked like he belonged there. And anyway, so he remembered who I was. You know, I went in and, you know, said hi, and, you know, we sat and talked a little bit. And he's like, so what brings you to Fayetteville? And I'm like, well, it's really funny you should ask that. you know, and so we haven't interacted much since then. I have an open door. I mean, I can reach out to them, but they've been quite busy. They had a building project over there, and we certainly wish them well. And we want, you know, they are confessional Lutherans. And so we're pulling for them, even though they may not pull back, but that's okay.
That's okay. Yeah. I know. I watched some of their, when we were investigating, streaming as a church, part of my research was to see what other churches were doing. And I watched some of their stuff. And I learned about the building project that way, that they were building. And I thought that was good. Anytime, you know, you have a need, I guess, to build, you know, that's good. That whether or not you should build is, I think, a different question. But if you're at the place where, like, you need to expand something or build something, I think that's, you know, that's good. As especially... Yeah, if you have a need and the resources then, right, to follow through with that. Because a lot of churches need things but don't necessarily have the resources to do it.
And I don't know what their entire situation is. A lot of times in the Wisconsin Synod, the way that I've always understood it was a home mission congregation, which I believe they were classified as, at least they used to be, does get a certain amount of help from the synodical level and stuff like that. So they're able to do that. And I think they used also a group called Builders for Christ, which is the Wells, basically, you know, bunch of retired guys that come in with hammers and tools and all that stuff. Yeah. And they'll help put stuff together. And, you know, there's cost to it. I think usually materials, stuff like that. But a lot of the labor is done, you know, just gratuitously. So that's just, so they had that type of, help and assistance there. And you know, like one of the things that makes it challenging for the Wisconsin Synod, they don't do chaplains. So there are no Wells chaplains in the army or in the armed forces at all. That's something, again, they have doctrinal issues with, fellowship issues, as you can understand, because if you're a chaplain in the army, you have to serve whoever it is that you're, you know, given to serve.
Right.
And so it's one of the reasons why the Wells try to always have churches, you know, somewhere near major, you know, military installations and stuff like that, to be able to provide something for the Wells guys who come to town, or girls, I should say, you know, who are enlisted and then sent to Fort Bragg or wherever, so that they have, you know, an opportunity to worship and fellowship with people. So that's something that they do.
I think the just the whole fellowship thing is fascinating. Just the way different people, I guess, approach it. Because I've always wondered how you handle that in like the context of like the military and a chaplaincy, as a chaplain or as a soldier, right? Like, what if you get assigned a female chaplain? What do you do?
Yeah. And I mean, there are options. I mean, we see it here. There are guys who come, you know, who don't necessarily go, you know, to on-base church and stuff like that, because they do have the opportunity to come elsewhere. And so that explains, you know, some of our, you know, people, yeah, you know, who are here. And this is where they choose to go. And the only, I guess the only prohibition we ever had, if you remember Chaps, our original chaplain and family, our youth group, right?
Who left
Hawaii. Yeah. And by the way, tell Sam I said hi. But
Joe says hi.
But I learned that apparently the DOD does not, they don't allow for chaplains to join churches. They can't join. So his family did, but he did not. The other guys, the other enlisted guys, you know, they do. They will join the church and become members. And,
right.
And many times, because being an army town, and I mean, not just an army town, the army town, really, you know, sometimes people will just attend. They'll attend regularly, but they won't ever really become members, because their full intention is to, you know, eventually go back to their home state or their, you know, and so that's just, and so church membership is one of those things that I don't really fret over, especially here, because there are members who are members, you know, even if they're not in the books, you know, as far as on our rolls or you know, on Sally's computer or whatever. So
members in spirit.
Yeah, I mean, and they really are confessional, you know, and they're one of us, and many of them are, you know, have memberships in LCMS churches elsewhere, and things like that. So the you know, it's not like we're gonna come down on them for that kind of stuff. So
right. What do you think is one of the bigger struggles of ministry in a military town like Fayetteville?
I think probably more than anything is some of the PTSD stuff, some of the things that guys have seen, and some of the baggage that they'll carry with them. And then, you know, Fayetteville's also, for whatever reason, army, you know, military type towns, bases and stuff like that will also attract different kinds of unique people. You know, so human trafficking is a big deal, unfortunately, because we're right off I-95. You know this, and drugs.
Drugs are huge.
Yeah, it's a huge deal, and that stuff makes its way on post. So I mean, guys, I had one of our members tell me one time that, and this was obviously being a little bit, you know, exaggerated, but something like 99.5% of soldiers are kind of like dirtbags. And that was, you know, but I think there was some truth to that, you know. You end up finding sometimes some people that might have no other option, and for sadly understandable reasons, end up coming, you know, into the army as sort of a way of getting out.
Yeah.
But it doesn't necessarily mean someone's changing. On the flip there side was... of that, as I say, go, Chris, you remember, you know, Chris, he had, he's one of those guys that'll tell you the army changed him. It saved his life. So it depends, you know, it can go both ways like that. So.
I know there was a big problem right around 9/11. They started pushing like, we need everybody in the army. We're going to Iraq or whatever. And there was a big push for years where we just needed as many bodies as we could get in the service, especially the mid to later sort of Bush years. And a lot of like actual gangs like MS-13 and others realized like, wait, you're going to pay us to go over to Afghanistan where the best poppy in the world is, and we can just ship that stuff back for free on Uncle Sam's dime. And so there was a huge opioid trade that the army was inadvertently facilitating, because gang members were joining on purpose, getting placed in units on purpose, getting promoted to certain ranks on purpose, so that when we get to the place where the guy who's signing off on all the shipments is a gang member, the guy receiving it's the same gang. Now, all of a sudden, we're going to strike up a deal with these Afghani poppy farmers and start shipping opioids back to the U.S. on you know, military aircraft, bypass customs and everything, right? Oh, it's just a shipment from the army, you know?
Yeah, free. Yeah, that's one of the things that, and opioids in general, oh my goodness. Mm-hmm. I mean, I see it just in our neighborhood even.
Yeah.
Or outside of our neighborhood. I mean, it's just, my neighbor's son OD'd on heroin not too long ago. Thankfully, he's well. He's well now. But it's just, that stuff just gets a hold of people. And the problem, the real problem is, it's because it's affordable. It's affordable.
Yeah,
is what it is. It's not something that's, you know, that is, you can get a hold of it, you know. And that's a big problem here. I mean, it's an issue. I think we had we used to do community watch meetings here for the neighborhood. Yeah. And we had a detective here who was basically the head of our human trafficking division for the Fayetteville Police Department.
Golly.
The only police department in the state of North Carolina that actually has a human trafficking division. Even Raleigh's and even Durham's, it's part of another division. We have actually our own, which is just dedicated towards it. And I'll tell you what, man, I listened to that guy when he was here and explaining some of the things. And obviously, he can't even go into all the details.
Right.
But the details he could go into, I thought to myself, man, how is this guy not drunk every single night of his life? Because, I mean, how do you live like that? I just don't know how you can, you know, endure that kind of stuff. And obviously, if it's a big enough deal for us to require our own personnel to be able to address it and so on.
A lot of people, I think, don't. I read somewhere once from, I think it was an interview with an FBI agent, and he says that the FBI requires everyone to go through the Child Crimes Division for at least a year. And he said that no one is permanent in that division except for a few guys that are. Everybody else, they do their tour and they get out and they go, you know, where they really want to go in the FBI. And he said that the few people that are like that's what they do all the time, they're all divorced. They are all drunk every night, because like, how else like do you deal? You know, you can't. It's not. I don't know. And then we got Robeson County up the road, like right up the road. They have a whole division in their police force dedicated to solving cold case murders.
Yeah. That's my claim to fame with my family back in Chicago. As I tell them, I'm literally 2 minutes away from the county where Michael Jordan's dad died. We are, you say right up the road. Yeah, for us in particular, it's our vet is in Robeson County.
Yeah.
And it takes us 2 minutes, skids up to skids down from our driveway to their parking lot.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we're right there. And because we're on the two, you know, sort of the cusp of the two, I mean, you've been to our place before and been down Parkton Road, you know, the highway off which we live. And, you know, you see, you've got a lot of poverty down there.
Yeah.
There are roads, streets that are just literally dirt. You know, maybe have two or three little houses on there and stuff like that. And it's just, it's sad. It's sad to see, but, it gets in there. As a matter of fact, one time, One time Adrian was coming home on the bus, and apparently they go to our neighborhood first and then sort of make their way back towards the school and stuff like that. And kids would sometimes, you know, they tell him, boy, you live with the rich people. And I'm like, wow. Oh, but they really don't know me, do they? Because we, you know, or anything but.
Yeah.
But that's how they would talk. And it was funny because they'd ask him, he's like, do you have any candy or anything you can give us and stuff like that? And he would. He'd just hand out pieces of gum and stuff like that to people because he's like, I didn't know what else to do.
You know, they're
asking for it and stuff. And that's happened on occasion. And that's kind of how it is, I guess, in Cumberland and Robinson County is, you know, mm-hmm. we all live together. Everyone's on a little bit of a different social strata, and there's only one way to make it work, and that is just to live together.
Yeah.
And we see that as a church here. We've had somewhat of a homeless population that has cropped up, and have been sleeping around, you know, our fellowship hall and things like that. We do our best. We do our best to be able to, you know, to take care of people, to you know, help them out and do what we can. We don't you know, shoo anyone away or anything else like that. But, you know, we had a situation just today, actually, where our garage, our shed, our church shed was somehow or another broken into. Mm. Things were taken out of it and we were losing. So, I mean, it's unfortunate. We want to be open. You right. know, we want to be able to help everyone. But on the other hand, we also can't, you know, take undue risks either. And
right.
That's just what we live with every day, helping people. You know, people come to our door, and you sort of need to make a judgment call on some of these things. And sometimes you might even be wrong, but you kind of need to make a. Although there was the one time, a guy stopped by the church who was pretending to be a girl, and was looking for gas. Or he wanted cash is what he wanted, money,
right.
wanted to, you know, and stuff like that because he needed gas and I offered to put gas in. He's like, well, no, I filled it up with diesel and I have to run all that out now. And all. And so finally I asked him, I said, so where are you going? And he's like, well, I'm on my way to a funeral and from Ohio. And I'm like, oh, where's the funeral? And he's like, it's in Denver. So I'm like, have you took a wrong turn, son. You drove all this way, and so you know. So sometimes they, you know, the you know they're kind of put on a tee for you. You can sort of realize, okay, there's something, you know, something not right about this, and
yeah,
and, you know. But it's unfortunate that you have to do that.
Do you think, like, as the church universal, the church Catholic, as Christians, do we have any kind of an obligation if we're able to help lift people out of their poverty or alleviate their poverty in some way?
I think alleviate would probably be the better word. We can mm-hmm. certainly do, you know, what we can. We're limited, though. And that's unfortunate. I've had to tell people, you know, before, I just so you know, we are a church. We're not a bank. And, right. you know, we do our best, and we can. And I think for alleviating, yes. But I think Christ's words that the poor you will always have with you is pretty much a promise. And, you know, and yeah. we see that here, you know, with very much clarity here. And so getting them to a different, like, social state, if you will, or economic type state or whatever, that would be ideal. We'd love to do that. I don't know of any Christian who would think otherwise, but is it absolutely our, you know, obligation? And so I don't know. You know, it's one of, there was a program that one of our AALC churches used to support. And I think this is a program in the state of Iowa. And I remember talking to this pastor about it. I don't remember the name of it or anything like that, but it was a program that would help people who were homeless and people who were dealing with poverty. But it also taught them some, like, life skills,
mm-hmm.
job skills. It went out of its way to get them so that they could start to really get back on their feet. And I remember him telling me about this at one of our pastor's conferences, and I was just I was quite intrigued. It was it's nice, but I'll tell you, I don't believe it's a church related program. I think it was a state related program, and you know, you need some pretty deep pockets. You need some, a lot of support to be able to do stuff quite like that. Recently, I've actually had the discussion about possibly even doing literacy classes here at the church, because you know, illiteracy is a problem. And
yeah,
it's a problem here, and I've realized that sometimes there have been people who've been pounding on our door. And it took me until after the fact to realize that, you know, we have a little sign that says, you know, for assistance, ring the doorbell. They couldn't read it. So they were just pounding on the door. And that's just, you know, that's what would happen. And so that's something that we've thought about, you know, possibly pursuing as some sort of outreach program, something that we can do in the community. As you know,
I'm always willing. If the state is funding it, I'm always willing to co-opt that.
Oh yeah, and I mean, it's, you know, to get back to the wells, and so, you know, the Wisconsin, last time I checked, anyways, was a school choice state, and so that benefited a lot of the Wells schools there, especially schools like in Milwaukee and stuff like that, where people, you know, you either the Milwaukee Public School, which, you know, I don't know if it's as bad as Chicago Public Schools, but I mean, they've got quite a reputation themselves, or they could go to this private Lutheran school, and they were able to use vouchers to do that. And right. So, and I think the Wells, you know, what their leadership always was like is, hey, that's great. It's a blessing from God. And until if and when it becomes, you know, not so much a blessing from God, if they start saying, okay, now if we're going to allow you to take voucher money, now you need to start saying thus or not saying this or right. not teaching this. And so they realize, well, use it until, you know, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away, kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. It's, I'm always shocked at things like literacy rates. 'Cause you know, we have globally, I think at this point in time in human history, we're probably the most literate we've ever been. But it's always shocking when you run across someone, like at my day job, I'll ask someone to sign a form and they can't, you know, they have to, you know, make a little X or something. And it's always kind of shocking. I think I don't know. I don't know. You're right, though. The poor you'll always have with you. That's like, it's almost, it's a guarantee, right? It's not a, you know, it's a promise. There's always going to be people to care for, and who knows, you know, like I might be one of those people. I've been those people before, and I might be again, you know?
Well, and you know, that's one of the things, you know, the nurse and I have, we've been there too. We've been there too. I mean, when we still lived in Illinois, there were times where we had something like $46 in our checking account, and you know, we had the four kids and all this and stuff. And so, I mean, there were times where it got, you know, it would get, and since we've been here, we've been tremendously really blessed. And I'm not talking about rich, you know. I'm not. You know how much I get paid. So
I do, to the penny.
But, yeah. But no, the Lord blessed. I mean, he, you know, having us close in a house and getting all these things in order. And it's one of those things where if you've lived like that in the past, you're constantly like looking over your shoulder, like, sort of like waiting. Okay, at what point in time does this all stop?
Right.
And then you see inflation and all these things. You know, people, you know, looking $5 for a gallon of milk and some of the stuff. You know, because we still have mouths to feed, and now we have one more because our college kid is home, and so that's, you know, so that's, we get back to that, and it's like, you know, it was one of those things to where Adrian went hunting this year for the first time and got a deer with a crossbow. At first I was kind of like, well, I'm not really, you know, interested in eating venison or anything like that, but now we're thinking every year we're hoping he gets more, you know, to keep stuff in the freezer or whatever and stuff. So what's difficult about that, I think, especially with this last year or so after, you know, the lockdown and some of the things, you know, that have become more challenging with gas prices and all this other stuff like that is, you know, it affects after a while, not just your own bottom line, taking care of your closest neighbors, which are your family, you know, your wife and kids and stuff like that. But then it starts to affect your ability to help other people. And it gets a little frustrating that way. One of the things that I love is our local store is Carly C's grocery store. And Michelle refuses to go there. She says, because it's just, I call them my people, right? They're like down home, Hill people. It's where you go when you want to get pickled pig's feet, stuff like that. It's just, and during Christmas, around Thanksgiving into Christmas and all that, they sell bags of groceries that they send to the local food pantries. And it's like $5 or $10. And all you do is you bring the bag up there and, you know, ring it up with your order. And they take the bag, they put it aside, and then it ends up getting delivered, you know, later on at some point in time. But it's like, that's like a ball on a tee, you know, as far as work's prepared and that's for us to do. It's you know, so simple. But even then, you worry, and I know we're not supposed to, but you at least ponder the thought that at what point in time am I not going to be able to do that comfortably? Or am I going to be faced with deciding, okay, am I going to put $10 worth of gas in my car? Or am I going to be able to buy this bag of groceries and stuff? And I think that's been kind of, you know, the running theme of most of the outreach and ministry that we do here at Christus Victor. It's always been, you know, who can we help? Who can we serve that can't give us a dime, that can't give anything to us? And you know, consequently, the Lord has blessed us, and I'm careful to tell pastors or other people that, like a quid pro quo kind of thing. If you do this, you know, if you really focus on this, God will give you money, or God will take care of your, you know, finances or ability. I don't, you know, that's not true. There's no real promise of that, but it does a little bit call to mind Jesus, where he says, "Seek first the kingdom," you know, "seek first his righteousness and all these." I mean, he knows we need food. You know, he knows we need clothes. He knows we need that stuff, and so, but that's always been our thing. You know, to sort of look at who we can serve that, you know, we're not looking for their pocketbooks. You know, we're just looking to be able to serve them, especially with the gospel.
My view is that if you know someone needs the $10 and you've got $15 to your name, I've always thought you should go ahead and give the money, because, you know, it'll work out. It'll work out. Like you said, God knows you need food. He knows you need clothes. Jesus said something about that, flowers and birds and whatnot. And, you know, I don't know. I always err on going ahead and giving the money and assuming the thing works out. But I'm weird, because I don't know. I genuinely believe that, like, a lot of people are like, oh man, it's lunchtime and I'm hungry, so I need to eat. You don't need to eat. You need to pray. Like, that's the thing you actually need, you know. Or like, oh, it's getting late, I need to sleep. No, you don't need to sleep. You need to pray. And I think a lot of people don't think about that enough in that kind of, you know, oh, that's a little too extreme there, Remy. Yeah, it is, I think, probably for our culture, but, you know, I don't think it's necessarily too extreme for God.
I think our priorities can always be rearranged.
Yeah.
I mean, always. And that's pastors included, obviously. I mean, we can, you know, that's always a thing. I think the thing I run into, you know, when you're looking at, when you're talking about, you know, serving, you know, your neighbors or serving those in need, or serving, is in my particular situation, you know, I've also got, you know, two sons, you know, at home, and, you know, obviously my wife and now my daughters are back, and stuff like that. So I've got to look at that too, you know.
Yeah. You don't want to be put in a situation where you're not able to take care of them, because that would be sort of you, you know, abdicating your duty as their father, as husband.
Right. And that's that kind of calls to mind, you know, when Christ is, you know, railing on the Pharisees about, you know, the fact that you devoted all this stuff to God, you know, to this stuff like that, and you can't even lift a finger to help your parents.
Right. Kind of thing. Yeah.
And so it's a balancing act. It really is. But we'd love to help out, you know, as much as we can. Martin Luther, and by no means, first of all, I want to make it clear, and I think most people who listen to this are probably going to know that, I don't read Martin Luther. I don't read much of I used to get that all the time from some Calvinists. Well, have you ever even read John Calvin? I'm like, I'm going to stop you right there.
I haven't even read Luther.
I don't even read much Luther either and stuff like that. You know, but I know he was a man, you know, having been a monk and all that stuff like that, you know, having taken that vow of poverty and stuff like that, you know, he seems to have been someone who was a little bit more, would have been reckless with finances. Mm. You know, hey, just give the farm away, give it all away. Or Katie,
well, and
Katie wasn't.
And, right.
And that ended up blessing them on an occasion.
I don't have kids, right? So, like, for me and my wife, if we got to a point where we said, hey, we need to give money to the church for this thing, or we really feel like, you know, this is where this money needs to go, and we did that, and then we're sitting there with no money for groceries, not having kids, I'm like way more than willing to say, well, tonight for dinner, we're going to, you know, read this psalm. That's, you know, that's what we got. Thankfully, I don't think we've ever been in quite that dire. I think one time in the past like 5 years, we've literally not had money for food. So God's been good. I find myself not worrying about like everybody's talking about inflation and gas prices, and my groceries are going up, and I have friends that have their grocery bills on like spreadsheets, and they're tracking like year over year how much they're spending on groceries. I think we're actually spending less on groceries this year than we ever have. I don't worry about it, because like it'll be there.
I admire those people who can budget and plan like that.
I really do.
I don't. My idea of budgeting or balancing the checkbook, if you will, is going on the PNC app and seeing, well, how much money do I have? You know, and
you know,
can I buy this rifle, or can I do the, you know, and that's my idea of taking care of finances. But I feel very similar to that in the sense that when food, you know, was when people were hoarding.
Yeah.
Right. At the beginning of the pandemic and stuff like that. And, you know, people were hoarding, like, you know, taking meat and taking all kinds of things from the stores, you know, that I would go to. And, you know, I figured, well, you know, I could do this. I could make a run, you know, like Kinlaw's or something like that, in one of these places, and pick up a bunch of meat and throw it in our freezer, you know, sort of, you know, to try to cover ourselves. And I decided, no, you know what? This is a trust thing. So every day, after, you know, pretty much after work, I'd, you know, go past the Carly C's, and I'd go in, I'd say, I'll see what the Lord's given us for dinner tonight. And that's what it was. And sometimes it was different things, like, you know, it may have been something that we don't normally eat, but it was there, you know, was there. And that's the way I decided to approach that whole thing, instead of, you know, panicking, I guess you'd say.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's fear, love, and trust, right? It's where do you, as a creature, where do you put your fear, your love, and your trust? And it's got to be Christ, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's all you can do.
Yeah.
I mean, at the end of the day, that's all we pretty much have, really. And it's funny because, you know, for Mother's Day, I bought the nurse a bunch of these planters and stuff, you know, so she could plant more tomatoes and peppers and stuff like that. And you know, there's a part of me that sits back and starts thinking, you know, like with Adrian hunting and, you know, teach Peyton how to fish, and, you know, I go out and, you know, let's prep, you know, let's can some things, you know. And to some degree, we do that because we kind of learned it from, you know, a lot of people that are here. Let's be honest. We have a congregation that has quite a few preppers in it.
Yeah.
it's what they're used to. They expect something, you know, down the road, you know, and I'm not talking necessarily about like apocalypse and stuff like that, but they want to be prepared. You know, and I don't know if that's the Boy Scouts thing that's just carried over into the Army or whatever it is.
I think, carried over and amplified.
Yeah. And so we do some of that, you know, that happens, you know, we try to be, you know, but at the end of the day, you're right. It's fear, love, and trust. And, you know, the Lord's, he's going to give it to us. And he does in his own time and in his own way.
I also like that you're like inadvertently raising your kids to, be able to like live off the land if need be. That's great.
Yeah. Well, and it's, and I like how you use inadvertently because,
it seems to be like their interest, right? Like
it is. But like in the case of like Adrian and hunting and stuff like that, it's Mike. It's who it is. It's a member of our current. He's the one. It's funny. I've never hunted in my life and I don't plan on it. Right. Right. I didn't grow up with a dad who hunted. All of us guys who lived in Chicagoland, if your dad did hunt, he hunted in Wisconsin. That was just what they did. But my dad did not, so I didn't, you know, grow up doing any of that stuff. But they get a lot of influence from a lot of different people here, and mainly the men. Mainly the men have been really a big influence on my kids, even my daughters as well.
Yeah.
And then you know, I've talked enough about Adrian, I'm sure, in social media and stuff like that. Ever since he could crawl, he's wanted to be a soldier, and so it was easiest of all the kids for him when we relocated to this town. Then for him to and that's still his plan, by the way.
Yeah,
that's still his goal and what he plans to do and all of that. And, it's funny. I was getting rid of his Nerf guns not too long ago because I was cleaning out my garage for like the 8 millionth time, which is another joy of having kids and dogs and chickens and all that other stuff, is that you get to clean the garage a lot. And I was getting rid of his Nerf guns. And, you know, the nurse is like, well, why are you getting rid of them? I'm like, he has guns now. He doesn't need these anymore. You know, they don't do him, you know, any good. And so, yeah. But that's just, they fit in well. They do fit in well.
So. Have you ever thought about I had a friend a long time ago that used to pose this kind of question to me all the time. 10 years ago, you were still back in Chicago. You were doing whatever you were doing. Would you have ever thought, like, if someone came to you and said, hey, 10 years from now, you're going to be living in North Carolina. One of your kids is going to be an avid hunter. Your other kid's going to have a BMW. And your daughter's off at college with some North Carolina boy. Like, would you have believed any of this?
I like how you throw the Beamer in there. Just to tell everyone that I don't get paid all that much. But
He bought it himself.
And he's making the payments on his own, yes.
Yes, with his own little job. Look at him. When I met him, he was – how old was he? I've been at Christus Victor for 4 years now, so he was 14, 15?
That's possible. I'm not good with ages. That's not my thing. I have to, or birthdays. If I'm filling paperwork out at the doctor or whatever, I'm like, how old are you? You know, it's just, I'm not even good with my own age. I will often have to text my wife, how old am I again?
You know, right.
If I don't remember and I need to know for something and she'll just text me back. She's gotten used to it now. She used to just say you're too old or whatever. You know, but now she knows he actually does not know. So I actually have to inform him of that. But no, actually, to answer your question, when we had never even thought about the state of North Carolina. It had never once crossed our minds to ever even think about like going on vacation, you know, out towards like Wilmington or, you know, the Outer Banks or, you know, anything like that. The only travel we would ever do would have been to Tampa, where her brother lived. And that was like a 25-hour drive, you know, from where we were living. And so, no, it had not crossed my mind. But or if someone told me that I would have a duck, you know, running around my driveway or, you know, chickens, never even thought about, you know, stuff like that until we moved here. And I think, you know, part of it is one of our license plates, you know, in North Carolina, there's the phrase, you know, first in flight because of the Wright brothers, which of course is the one that I have, right? Because it's planes. And the other one is first in freedom. And there's something about that notion of freedom, you know, among my neighbors and the people, you know, that live here, especially when you get out the country and stuff like that, you know, where people, you know, they'll raise their own animals. They'll do their own things. They'll whether they live on a farm or not. I mean, it doesn't matter. But yeah, if someone told me that 10 years ago, I would have, you know, told them to have another drink, because there's just, you know, that's not, it never crossed my mind. And neither did the AALC. I didn't know anything about the AALC until probably 7 years ago, maybe 8 years ago. I had actually met Pastor Rich Shields, who was used to be our seminary president at the time when I'd first met him. And I met him on Twitter. So that's how this whole thing ended up happening, as I met him. And at one point in time, I sort of brought up the subject of colloquy, you know, and the AALC ministry and stuff like that. And then they ended up sending me a packet of colloquy questions and all these things like that. And it sat on my desk in my house in Illinois for like the entire summer while the colloquy meeting came up then that following fall. And so he kept kind of nudging me and, hey, you know, you might want to get that packet in and get that. And so finally I went, and every night after I was working at an insurance agency, every single night here, I'm in the library typing out probably 70 pages worth of answers to these questions, right? You know, because you're trying to sound like you're smart and stuff,
right? Yeah, yeah.
Pastorly and all that stuff. And finally, I did the 5-hour drive to St. Louis and had like a 3-hour colloquy meeting, you know, interview with them. They didn't talk one thing about any of the theological questions. Not one. I'm like, I went through all that. I wrote out all that.
And you did like a whole new master's thesis.
Well, and they were just like, well, we weren't really worried about your theology, you know.
Great.
Oh, I said, so they're worried about other things, and understandably so, I guess.
That's awesome.
It's wild how fast life can change. I'm pretty sure I've told you this before, but I got into Reformed theology, and then I started watching like Chris Roseborough and some others, and I said, well, let me check out this Luther guy. And I was really big into Roseborough because he just happened to like really speak to sort of a part of my life that I felt like a lot of these Reformed people didn't understand. And him growing up and sort of the holiness movement himself and the charismatic theology himself, I think he kind of really understood like a lot of the pain that I had from that. And I remember saying, well, I want to go to whatever kind of church Roseborough is. And I looked it up and I saw that he was in the AALC. And then I said, okay, well, so I want to be in the AALC. And then I saw that there was like 83 AALC churches in the whole like U.S. And I was like, oh, well, what are the odds one's going to be even within a 2-hour drive of me? And I'm prepping myself for like a 45 minute to an hour drive every Sunday if need be. And I pull up the church finder thing, and there's one literally 5 minutes from my house. And it was Christus Victor. And I was like, look at that. That's a sign, right? Like, that's got to be a thing. And I don't know. I think I ended up exactly where I was supposed to be. You know, it's wild.
Yeah, I have no question about that. I think it's been a blessing for me, too, though. Because the fact of the matter is that, you know, as you mentioned, the 83 churches, and, you know, we're oftentimes, especially when you're outside of the Midwest, you know, you're outside of that Minnesota, Iowa area where, you know, a lot of our AALC churches are, we're on islands, we're on something of an island. So it's good. It's always good to have people, who can step in and help out. And, you know, you know, I'm sure some people probably know this, that you're the one who fills in for me, you know, if I leave, or if I'm, you know, going to be gone or, you know, out of town or whatever. Yeah. And that's, a lot of guys don't have that. What they would have to do would be write a sermon and have it probably read by an elder, or someone in the church council or something of that. And I haven't had to have that. And, you know, between, well, you and then, you know, when Chaps was here, and we've had other chaplains in the past come and go and stuff. So there's usually options, but
I think when I first started attending Christus Victor in the congregation, so we had Robert, who was vicar, and then we had Chaps 1 and Chaps 2. So, like they're, like, ordained Lutheran pastors, like, in the congregation. And there always has been. I don't think we've ever not, you know, because now we have Pastor Emeritus, Chaps, I guess, the third.
Yeah.
So
yeah, he's here. Yeah, so we have, you know, that's like I said, in the AALC in general, it's something that a lot of guys just don't have.
Yeah.
They don't have that luxury, and it's helpful. It's definitely helpful, and it is interesting. You'd mention, you know, the AALC, and then just looking and finding, oh look, there's one, you know, next door.
And the odds, I mean, really astronomical.
Oh, it's crazy. And you'd mentioned Chris and his radio or podcast show or whatever, you know, from before. I think the second year we were here, Peyton was playing fall league soccer in Hope Mills at the Park District, and there was a guy that was there who was wearing one of a Pirate Christian Radio shirt.
Wow.
And it was funny because I didn't have my glasses on. I didn't have any eye. So I couldn't fully tell. I could kind of tell. And I was telling Bryn, I said, hey, we'll walk over there and see what that guy's shirt says, you know, and all this. And, you know, try to, you know, be nonchalant about it. Just sort of look and see and come back and tell me and stuff. And so finally I just walked up to him. And then what really cracked me up is sometime after that you came, you know, and then the one day when we were having men's breakfast, you're like, I invited my buddy. I invited my buddy over here. Yep. And it turns out that's him.
Yep.
That's him.
Brian. So,
yep. It's a small confessional world out there when you really think about it.
And I met him too. I met him, in another unrelated Facebook. It was a Lutheran Facebook group, but it wasn't through Rose Bros stuff. It was something else. It was some kind of other theology group that I met him in. And then it turned out he lived in Fayetteville.
Yeah. And it's been a while. I gotta get shoot a text out to him for the next men's breakfast, because I think he did enjoy coming to those.
Yeah.
He probably just thought maybe during the pandemic or whatever that we may have just kind of cut some of that stuff out. I don't know.
Well, I know they were going to a Baptist church up the road, and the pastor there got a little weird. So anyway.
That happens.
Yeah. Joe, thank you so much, man.
Yeah. Anytime.
Yeah. We'll do it again sometime. We'll talk about all the things we didn't get to touch on today, like death, witchcraft, and metal.
Yeah, that sounds great. As a matter of fact, let's do that soon.
Okay.